Oh my goodness. You're back for another exciting, wonderful, historic episode, I'm going to say on this one, of The Rational Revolution. You know, this show typically talks about news and current events and all these types of things, but occasionally I want to go outside the racing line here, if you will, and that is absolutely a foreshadowing. I'm going to talk to you just a little bit and set this up. I have been a huge fan of auto racing since I've been 7 years old. Cars has been a big part of my youth, and now I run a car dealership, so that's part of that is ingrained in who I am. I do race myself. I compete on the local dirt track circuit in a street stock. Let me tell you what, that's a hell of a time. Growing up, my favorite driver was the Tide car of Ricky Rudd, and that was a blast to watch. But then my eyes were opened, and I found a series called Championship Auto Racing Teams, or CART. It was an open wheel series that kind of is like a modern day IndyCar. It competed with IndyCar. And my favorite drivers morphed from Ricky Rudd to people like Alex Zanardi, Greg Moore, Juan Montoya, Dario Franchitti, some of those names you might know. And this series had the best drivers in the world. They raced in iconic tracks like here at Road America, Michigan International Speedway, streets of Long Beach. They even raced at an airport in Cleveland, which was my favorite track, by the way. And the series itself was larger than life. And it was really cool because my brother and I bonded over each one of the races. We lived and died by the results of that week's race. And then we, of course, counted down to the start of the next race. And we hung on every word that came from the microphone of the timeless and legendary broadcaster, Paul Page, who now joins us today on The Rational Revolution. I cannot tell you how honored I am to have you here, Paul. Thank you so much.
It's great to be here. That was quite an introduction. Those were good days too, weren't they?
They were. I mean, it was such an incredible time to be a fan of motorsports. And, you know, like, what you've done in not only motorsports but broadcasting in itself is remarkable. You know, you did everything from motorsports to the Nathan's hot dog eating contest. For God's sakes, I found out. But I kind of want to, you know, you are an iconic name in racing.
Well, thank you. Nice to say.
And you know, you were the voice behind some of the most famous moments in the sport. You know, how did you get involved in broadcasting?
Well, I actually got more involved in racing first. I went to the Indy 500 when I was 15 years old, and I just thought, man, I got to do something that involves this.
Okay.
So cool. And then when I was away in the Army, I had kind of an interest in broadcasting, and I'd done a little something in high school, but when I was in the Army, I actually went to a school for military broadcasters.
No
when
kidding.
I got then back to Indianapolis, I got a job, a small job at a small radio station, and at the same time I was working for George Bignotti at his shop. And so I had the best of both worlds going for me. But of course, the job at Bignotti's was kind of a quid pro quo. You can come to the races as long as you come to the shop and work. but one thing led to another, and I became I was primarily doing radio news, which I really enjoyed at a station in Indy called WIBC, which was the flagship station for the Speedway Radio Network, the Indianapolis Speedway Radio Network. And one thing led to another. I met the guy who created that network, Sid Collins, and yes, he and I became close friends, and he started grooming me to be a play-by-play sportscaster of motorsports. And when he passed away, the job came to me. It was really that simple. And, you know, I just came to it with passion. I wanted everybody to feel about it the way I felt about it. So that's how I tried to portray it in a way that would would say that this is cool, and these people are worth every moment of your attention.
Yeah, and you know, and for those who don't know Sid Collins, he was the person who coined the term the greatest spectacle in racing in reference to the Indianapolis 500, which I think it absolutely is all of that. So racing was the end goal. That was a question that I was going to ask you. So it was something that you wanted to get into broadcasting, but you wanted to get into broadcasting specifically to call motor races.
Right. There was actually a period of time there when I actually thought I was a race driver.
And, really?
I raced in the SCCA in a Formula Ford.
That's right.
In fact, I took my driver's school, my first driver's school at Road America.
Oh, no kidding.
And at the time, I didn't know anything about Road America, despite the fact that I'm a military brat, and my last place that I lived with the family was on the north side of Chicago.
Okay.
So I really should have known about it, but I was more focused on Indy and stuff like that. But I knew I wanted to try to be a race driver, and I ended up going to the SCCA, and you had to take two driver schools. One was here in Indianapolis, and the other was Road America. And Augie Papps was our chief instructor. And just pulling up to Road America and saying, oh, my goodness, look at this place.
Yeah.
It was so cool, and it really, really was an enjoyable time, and I loved going back there. But anyhow, my 7-year career of racing Formula Fords and SCCA netted me, I think, 3 pewter cups.
Oh, nice.
And certainly no cash. And
no.
I said, you know, this is really not for you. You can drive fast, which I could, but I could not compete strongly against other guys right alongside of me. I mean, I did okay, but
I would imagine. I would imagine
you probably know the same feeling. You know, you're there, you're fast, but you're not quite fast enough.
Right. I would imagine that gives you a lot of perspective on what it took to call a race. You know, actually going through the turns and seeing what the drivers go through.
Yeah, especially since a lot of the drivers out of that era, well, still many of them today, come through the Formula Ford ranks on their way to the pros, and with the Formula Ford of that day, with no aerodynamics, you really had to know how to I call it love the car.
Mm.
You have to be able to get it in and out of corners smoothly. It didn't have any real power to speak of, so you learned management of power, and it was a great car to learn how to race in.
Yeah, this past weekend actually I went to my first SCCA race, and it was the June Sprints at Road America that we had.
Oh my God, is that the greatest or what?
It was. Oh my gosh. Well, and so a friend of mine, he operates and he manufactures and like soups up Mini Cooper B-Spec. So a B-Spec for listeners is like front wheel drive, like a Ford Fiesta or, you know, and they take these cars and strip them all down and make them little mini rocket ships. And I called our local SCCA guy who does all the testing and everything. And I said, well, I have racing experience. So, you know, do I have to still go to the school? And I didn't hear back because I called him on that Thursday, and that was June Sprints, which is, I mean, hundreds of cars was there.
Yeah.
And then I went to my first event, and I was just like gobsmacked by, you know, the difference in what I do racing in circles on a dirt track to what it takes to do that, even at that low level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And so
I will tell you, I'll tell you a story. Since you mentioned June Sprints, of course, everybody wanted to go to.
Oh yeah.
And in the day we have, I guess what we were driving, you'd call Club Ford today.
Sure.
And our field was the full subscription for Road America, 80 Formula Fords.
Jeez.
And so there is the bridge going up the hill, right?
Yep.
And so the rule in SCCA was green to the front row is green to the field.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you qualified it's like in the 20th row or something. You wouldn't see the green flag
right.
when it
right.
came out.
Right.
You're coming up the hill.
Yeah.
So we got a guy to get on the bridge, and he had a little orange, bagel orange disc. And as soon as the green flag came out, he's on the bridge, and he starts waving that. And so we can see it. So now we're passing all these guys who don't know about that. that's a kind of a Roger Penske move.
Isn't oh, yeah. It? Yeah, I know. That's awesome.
We read the rules as closely as we could.
Yeah, that's right. And you followed them. That's right.
Yep.
It's within the rule. It was, I met a guy that was on the road to Indy. And his name is Bobby mm-hmm. Eberle. I'm sure he'll listen to this. He's a great guy. And he was on a quest to become the oldest rookie to ever qualify for the Indianapolis 500. And he ultimately didn't
do it.
Yeah, it was really cool. And, you know, he gave me like backstage passes, if you will, to when he was in Pro Mazda. Yeah. So that's like two rungs down from IndyCar. And that was a number of years ago. But to see those cars going full speed up that hill towards the green flag at Road America was one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had in my life. I hope people can do that at some point, because it really is remarkable. And then this past weekend, we went to, for the first time, I've been to Road America a number of times, but I've never been to Siepkins. And that is a very famous racing bar, and they have like autographs. I think Paul Newman autographed the wall. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of Mario Andretti, and he autographed that. And so, you know, it's so cool because, you know, I took my boys there, and they got to see the sights and hear the engines. And you know, I hope that they have a love for motorsports instilled in them, because then, you know, they get to go to these events and see the wonder and the awe that is performance race cars doing truly incredible things.
Yep.
Yeah, it is something. And it really was a remarkable experience. And we're going to continue this discussion on the other side with Paul Page. We're going to talk about how the industry of broadcasting works in motorsports. We'll be right back. Welcome back on the Rational Revolution. You've got Mark Becker, and we have a special episode here continuing with legendary motorsports broadcaster Paul Page is with us. And I want to talk about, I'm going to take you back to when you were in the thick of it. And, you know, one of the things that I think makes you so timeless is from a general broadcasting sense. You had the talent I could close my eyes and I could picture what was happening on the television. And I don't know if I've ever experienced that since. Radio broadcasters, you know, MRN, PRN, the guy, those folks, they come close, but it's not Paul Page. And how do you prepare for something like that?
Well, you have to paint the picture, and you have to think about how you're going to do that. And so you end up putting a lot of adjectives in there. You know, this color, this car is not just blue. I mean, it's royal blue, and it's sparkling in the sun, that sort of thing. And the more you do that, and the more you create that theater, the more you become accustomed to narrating in that particular way. And the idea then that when you are done, that you have painted some sort of a picture that the fan can follow. And if you look at television and the television part of my career, I was always taught to be, and by Sid and others, a storyteller. And we don't see that much of that today. That that's wrong. It's just the way things have gone. But when I was coming up, the real thing was with all of us was to tell the story, to have, here's a great example. Here's Al Unser Jr. and Emerson Fittipaldi, and they're racing for the win at the Indy 500.
Yes, yep.
And I decided as a television guy that I told the story. I set everything up, what it meant to those two individuals, how important, mm-hmm. how significant this was, how significant it was in the world of motorsports, because Indy is the pinnacle.
Yes.
And then I decided, we've been watching these two guys. We know what the story is. And I just went silent. And every lap or so, it was for about six laps, I would just say, you know, there's 15 miles to go. Laps to go.
Yeah.
And then I'd let it breathe. And so when they finally got to turn three on the final laps, and they got together and little Al spun, and Emerson went on to win, that picture had been painted. It was there visually, and you let the viewer, just help the viewer enjoy what's there.
Right. And so when those moments happen, you know, is it something where you can prepare for, like, or is this really just off the cuff that you kind of come up with these things?
Yeah, I see your further question, yes. There is. And that is, in my world, immersion. You have to talk to all of these people, and not just the drivers. You talk to team members and mechanics and owners and everything, and you just keep that conversation going. So you become part of that community and part of that flow. And by doing that, and then the real problem that I had was at the beginning, I would take all the publications and I'd read them.
Oh, okay.
And then I'd go to the track and I would start talking with people. And I'd end up being confused because talking to the people was real time.
Yes.
And sometimes the publications I was reading were like a week old. And so they were contradictory to one another. So I had to cut back on the publications quite a bit and just do primary research with all those guys. And, of course, being friends with many of them, that paid off a lot, too. And then the other thing about it was being honest with them. I would keep their secrets. They would come and tell me, hey, we're trying this at this race. If it works, you can talk about it. If it doesn't, shut up.
That's awesome.
And so, all of those things kind of paid off. And I talk about that actually quite a bit in my book. Hello, I'm Paul Page. It's Race Day in Indianapolis.
Yes.
It's more immersion than anything else. And when you're doing a series, you know, when you're doing one team for baseball and doing all their games, you get into that mode because you're with them all the time.
Yes.
And you have to make sure not only are you just with them, but that you're part of them. You're going out after the race with them, having meals with them.
Yeah.
You're having good times with them. We used to have, at Road America is a great example. We used to have a go-kart race up there, not at the track. That part of the track didn't exist. But we had a three-hour endurance go-kart race, and you could have three guys on your team. One had to be you, the non-racing of guy. And then you could have another non-racing guy, and then you could have a race driver.
One of the drivers.
And
oh, my God.
So, again, we did a Penske thing.
Okay.
I was the one guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we had Parker Johnstone.
No
who
way.
Was a retired racer.
Yeah, yeah.
Driver, but he
wasn't right.
as a broadcaster. So he didn't count as a driver.
That's good.
And then we had Juan Montoya
no
as our
way.
Driver.
Oh,
but
my
God. But the most
God.
Important thing is our fourth guy, we could have four. Our fourth guy was a kid that was a karting championship.
Okay.
Champion. And nobody knew him. And so we started him, and of course, he being a cart guy, he just disappeared from everybody else. And then we replaced him with Montoya, and we just had a ball. In fact, if you go to Siebkins, I doubt it's still there, but we used to have the Alamondo Cup. which was they finally retired it because we won 3 years in a row and everybody was mad at us.
So. Wow, what a story! But
you got to do those. You got to do those kind of things because that's where the friendships come out.
Well, and then the trust that you have to gain where to for the teams to say, okay, this is what we're doing. You can't not only can you not talk about it on the air, you can't share it with the other teams. And so,
right? No, exactly. I can't share it with the rest of broadcast.
Right. And so, yeah, you're the keeper of that secret, you know, and that's wild. And then, and during the broadcast, how did you, we got a minute left in the segment. How did you tune everybody else out to really focus on bringing that message to the country?
Well, the message of the secrets that I might have.
No, of the race, of the
across
action.
Across the board. Yeah. I that's the point where I sit down and I say, I'm going to treat the audience like they're sitting next to me in the grandstand.
How beautiful.
And they haven't been to a race. Some of them may have been to one or two. So I treat it that way, that I'm sitting with my friends and I'm telling my friends what's going on.
Mm. Yeah, that's awesome. And that was, you know, I think that's something that we're going to talk about here in the next segment, you know, because that's something that was so critical and so important of a key that you brought to the broadcast that I don't see in any form of motorsport right now. So we're going to talk about that on the other side. We've got legendary broadcaster Paul Page here in the Rational Revolution. We'll be right back. We all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you say you got a real solution? Well, you know. Welcome back to the Rational Revolution. This is a fun one. We've got my childhood hero, Paul Page, legendary broadcaster of open wheel and all things fast. Here on the show, and I wanted to talk about one of the things that you were so especially good at, and you kind of touched on it before the break, is I feel that if you're a fan of motorsports, it's a little bit of a niche thing, and so you have to kind of tell people why they should, like you said earlier in the show, put all of your attention to these humans that are doing incredibly remarkable things. And I think you had such a perfect balance between talking to people who tune in religiously every week, but also balancing that with welcoming in new people to the broadcasts and allowing them to learn.
So that's nice of you to say, because that was one of the objectives.
Oh, cool.
We knew that we were a niche and that there were a lot of people that didn't know us, but if they did, we thought that we would be able to keep them. And so you had to balance that broadcast with going for the connoisseur and making sure you put enough of that kind of meat into it, the little technical things or the little driver facts that they really love. But you also then had to almost constantly be updating the person that's just stepped into the chair for the first time. And so you really make me feel good that you say that, because that was part of our objective, was we had to figure out how to do both.
It was. And, you know, and I think, like, it's, you know, my son likes to watch NASCAR, and there's so often.
I'm sorry for him.
I know. Well, we're getting into to open wheel a little more because, you know, but the broadcasting, you know, every time they talk about, you know, the new one lug nut, which is so funny how that's like this remarkable, oh my God, moment for NASCAR. We went to one lug nut to hold on the wheel, which is what IndyCar and CART have been doing for 30 freaking years. But then they cut to this same graphic that goes for a minute and 45 seconds. That's like, okay, here we go again. You know, where you have someone that was a real professional that can explain that in layman's terms and then move on. Right. Yeah. And so that was something that was, it was so easy to get sucked into the world of CART because it was a circus. It really was.
Yes, it very definitely was.
And
we'd call it that internally.
Oh, did you really?
Uh-huh.
No kidding.
Yep, the circus is starting again. Here we go.
Yeah, right. And I mean, there was the highest of highs and the lowest of the lows. And I remember my favorite driver was the old Red Gloves, Greg Moore. He's a guy from Canada.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
what a beautiful human being.
Wasn't he? You know,
yes.
And I can remember, and the very moment in Fontana where Greg's tire dug in and he hit the wall head on. And Paul, I can remember the inflection of your voice when you watched it and you just said, "Oh my God." I remember that, Paul. I got goosebumps. I can remember that like it was yesterday. And they just celebrated, or not celebrated, they just, you know, remembered. What was it, 20 years since he died?
Yeah.
How? Something like, I mean, but I remember that. Like, it was yesterday. And I know it wasn't typically you that would have to break that news that someone has passed away. You know, it was typically Jerry Punch or a pit reporter or something. But inevitably, they always cut back to you. And it was you, the voice of comfort, the voice of, okay, guys, here's how we're going to get through this. I mean, I cried. When I was a little kid, I cried when I found out that Greg Moore had passed away. And the cameras turned to you. How do you deal with something like the unthinkable?
Well, I had to do it too many times.
Yeah.
If you were lucky, I say that advisedly, you'd have a bad accident, but the individual was not killed at the track.
Yeah.
And then it got delayed, and you didn't have to deal with it because it was announced after the race.
Oh, sure.
But when you had things like Greg Moore and Krasnov and Coletta, it just...
Scott Brayton, yeah.
It just rips your heart out, again, because they're your friends, they're your buddies, they're your brothers.
Yeah.
And Greg Moore especially, because that morning I was down doing my usual troll through the pits, and he and I were talking, and, you know, he had a great future coming. He was going to go to Penske the next year.
Yes.
And Lord knows how many races he would have won.
Oh, my God.
But he had wrecked his scooter the night before.
I remember that.
And in doing it, he broke some bones in his hand, and they created a special splint fiberglass thing to hold his hand so he could race. And he was laughing about it and laughing about, you know, the lidocaine that they were putting there is so good. Maybe they ought to put it in my butt so I won't feel how high the gravity G's are on the race car.
Yeah.
And we're just having a great time. And then to see that, and you do this long enough, you know instantly what it was. And then to have to wait, because everybody's got to be notified. It's all got to be dealt with. In that particular case, the people running IndyCar got a little off base in that they came up with this idea of they were going to lower the flags and call a yellow light and then make the announcement. And I thought, this is, you know, it's not what this is. This man has died. He's got a family crying. Well, this is not the time you do those kind of things. Mm-hmm. I was furious.
All right.
And on the other side of the glass next to me was the race control and Wally Dahlenbeck, the chief steward, and we just kept looking at each other like, what are they doing? Why are they doing it this way? And so finally we said, you know, they can do whatever they want. And they actually brought the flags down once and then they put them back up. They couldn't coordinate anything.
Wow.
And so I just said, we know everybody's notified. We're going to tell the audience because they need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Their hearts are in their mouths over that accident, too.
Yeah.
So, but dealing with those, then you reach down and you try to remember the good things and try to give some ease to the pain that I think everybody is feeling.
Right.
When you have those kind of things, just horrible. And you know, we're unlike any other sport, motor sports. It is not only possible, it is somewhat likely that you will have a serious or a fatal accident at one time or another.
Yeah, and here we're talking with legendary broadcaster Paul Page, and I think, it's no disrespect to the, you know, Scott Braytons of the world, but I think, you know, when you can see, Greg Moore was what, 24, I think?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
And the legacy that he left in his such short time in American open wheel racing, and everybody knows him, and everybody, you know, just remarks about what an incredibly, genuinely wonderful person he was. What a legacy that is, you know? And I can't imagine how many championships he probably gone to Formula One. Oh my God, he was so good. And
there is a little Greg Moore story there that I'll.
Okay, I'd love it.
When he was just trying to get an IndyCar or a kart ride at that time, one day I'm looking at this kid who is hanging around in front of Roger Penske's operation, his team set up at the track. And he's just standing. He stood there for a couple of hours. Every time I go by, this kid's still standing. And it was Greg Moore.
Really?
And he was looking for an opportunity to talk to Roger Penske. And so I finally said to one of Penske's lieutenants, I said, a guy named Dan Lugendew, I said, Dan, this kid's been standing out here, really wants to talk to Roger. What do you think? He said, oh, we got to get him in. And so they arranged for him to talk to Roger. And, of course, at that time, he didn't go to Roger. He was with Forsythe that year. But Roger liked him, and Roger was going to put him in a car in the next year.
That's crazy. That's so cool.
But he stayed with it. He's standing out there, and he's going to stand there until he gets to talk to Roger. And that was super.
That's awesome. Wow. And how much of that is, you know, does that exist today about, you know, and I don't know how it was with kart, but in IndyCar, there's a certain number of seats that, like, and I don't want to disrespect any drivers, but it's like they're not the best, because some of them, and it's a decent number, are paid, and they buy their way into the series. And was that like that back then as well?
It was. It wasn't as prevalent. And when I started, the driver got a portion of the purse.
No,
so you'll notice we never announce the purse anymore because we don't really know what it is.
Right.
But usually then 60% went to the driver, and the rest was then allocated to the owner and the team mechanics and you know, whatever else. Now it's not that way at all. You'll never hear what they're paid.
No.
And I actually think that in many ways, today the field is far deeper than it was back then.
Really?
I really believe any time they take a green flag now, that there's a good chance that 15 of them are capable of winning. But in those days, it was number more like 7 or 8. If you're really on top of it, you could probably tell that it was going to be this guy or that guy. And more often than not, you could say it's going to be that guy.
Yeah.
But you really had to be there, and you had to have the feeling, and you had to be talking to everybody and see what their attitudes were to be able to do that.
Yeah.
The thing I have with today's drivers that kind of bothers me is they've become corporate guys.
Yes.
You don't see, you know, well, you mentioned Alex Zanardi. It was just a joy to be around.
Oh, my gosh.
Always joking around, having a great time. He loved what he was doing.
Yeah.
Well, we've got Elio, who is that way.
Yes.
And we, you know, Tony Kanaan was certainly that way, but we're losing those guys, and we're losing them to guys who have been trained to be, and properly so. They got to develop a personality that a corporate boardroom will like.
Right.
And so no controversy, you know, they just try to, they're very vanilla.
Yeah.
And I wish some of them had more out there to say. I love it. Racing is conflict. So it can be conflict off the track too, you know?
Right.
So
I look at guys like, you know, on the Formula One side, my favorite guy is Fernando. You know, he's like,
oh,
that.
Oh yeah, of course.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And, you know,
but he's one of the few that they have.
Right. Right. You know, Lewis is a little bit like that, but he's not like, Fernando Alonso. And I, you know, it's really, it's interesting. And I, you think the parallels to Formula One, you know, we talked about it earlier in the show about the circus. I mean, to describe to the listeners what it was like. I mean, the glitz, the glamour, drama, excitement that CART had, the crowds. I in preparation for this discussion, I watched old races. Oh my God, mm-hmm. The crowds were huge.
Yes, they were.
You know, and how would you, we got a minute, but how would you describe the environment of the whole thing?
Well, in the days you're talking about with CART, part of the thing that happened was ESPN and all the cable networks.
Yeah.
When CART first started, there weren't that many. ESPN was there, but what it did was the whole marketplace got diluted over time. Mm-hmm. So now you could see beach volleyball and all, you know, everything else. But back in those days, there were primary sports, and motorsports was definitely one of them. And so that would attract people. And I hope that our broadcast attracted people. It's something that, so I want to be there the next time those guys are running in my area.
Yeah, and I know one of the things that attracted me to motorsports was the quality of the broadcast. And that's why when I went to Road America the first time, and it was in my adulthood, I took all of those memories that you gave me with me along to the track. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about where IndyCar, where motorsports is today on the other side of the break. We'll see you in a little bit. Welcome back to the Rational Revolution. This is awesome. We got Paul Page, legendary broadcaster, joining me here today, and this is an honor and a thrill. And again, thank you so much for being here.
I'm glad to do it. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about where the sport is today. So I bought your book. I bought the book that John Roskowitz had, called The Split, which talks about the split between IndyCar and CART, and then kind of comes back. And I started those books. But I want to talk about where IndyCar is today, because it is not the same as CART.
No, it's not. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, CART was such a thrill because it had so many different manufacturers. We had Mercedes and Honda and Toyota and Buick and Chevrolet and different cars. You look at what a car was like on an oval, and you had the Hondas with the swept wing that went down that looked like a stealth fighter, and you had the Chevys that had the straight wing, and it looked different. And today you have Chevrolet and Honda. I think Honda wants to get out of it, you know, if I read that article right, and all the cars are the same, and it's like NASCAR with open wheels, you know?
Right.
So it
very definitely is, it very definitely is a spec series now. It's Formula 4. The big cars. And, excuse me. In being that hands everything to the driver, but it takes some of the development excitement away.
Yes.
I mean, I really enjoyed it when we had all those different cars. And, you know, there was technology changes, and you could beat somebody with some small change to the way you designed your rear wing, or you put a splitter in certain places. You can't do any of that stuff.
No, none of it.
And so that hands it to the driver, but it takes away all the good things that the designers, the engineers, and the mechanics are capable of. What did it to them was cost.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Once they became mixed in with all the other sports, and now you're vying for ratings and time, the cost to create one of those cars started to skyrocket.
Hmm.
And the owners decided they needed more of a common car that was really strictly regulated. So now we have the Dallara.
Yep.
You can't do that much to it. My son is an engineer on the Andretti team.
Yes, that's right.
And he constantly says, you know, geez, I wish we could work on them more, but it's the goal they've been given. But yeah, it takes a lot of the background excitement away.
So what can they do to the car? He's an engineer. Like, is it internal, you know, with like tuning the engines, or is, you know, what kind of things can they do?
None of it. The engine comes in a case from either Chevrolet, which is really Ilmor. It's badged as a Chevrolet.
Okay.
Or from Honda, where it is a true Honda.
They're crate motors?
And they bring it in and they send an engineer with it. And you can't modify anything on that engine. You can't touch that engine.
Oh, my gosh.
And then with regard to the chassis, there are some small part replacements. And the sport itself is often calling for little changes, mostly related to safety.
Sure.
But any change that you make or want to make, you've got to get the clearance of IndyCar, and it has to be shared with everybody else. But that does keep overall costs down.
Yeah.
So you could do what Formula One does, which spends an ungodly amount of money.
A Bolt costs $5,000.
But their races are disappointing.
Yes.
I mean, I enjoy it. I watch them, but they're so single file.
Yes.
And then they got that whole DRS thing.
Yes.
That's a great idea, except if I'm coming up to pass you and I'm using DRS, you can't fight me back.
Right.
You're just a sitting duck. That'll make sense.
Right.
I mean, push to pass exists in IndyCar, but at least both of you can use it.
Right. You can fight it.
Yeah. It's more of a driver's series. And in many ways, that's good. We see some spectacular runs like we saw last weekend. I mean,
yes,
Paulo is just—he's an amazing little guy. And
is he long for IndyCar?
Got Colton Herta, which is.
Is he long for IndyCar? Or do you think he'll go to Formula One?
No, I think he'll stay in IndyCar.
Oh, cool.
Most of the guys that come to IndyCar, they end up staying there because they've trained. Maybe in one of the lesser series of Formula One, you know, they've done Formula 3 or Formula 2, and it's an atmosphere that it's not particularly pleasant for them.
Yeah.
And whenever one of them comes to IndyCar, even an ex-Formula One guy, it's like, wow, this is really fun.
Yeah.
Nigel Mansell, who I became pretty good friends with, you know, he just loved IndyCar.
He was the only person that held the F1 World Championship and the IndyCar Championship at the same time.
That's correct.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But he didn't get his Indy 500.
No, I know. I know. What is that?
And,
right.
And, yeah, that just drove him nuts.
I bet it did.
He wanted that so bad.
He was
so close, he made a tiny mistake.
Yes.
Brushed a wall, and that ended it.
That was it. What was your favorite track?
Well, Indy, of course.
Well, yes, right.
But that's, you know, that's... There are so many historical reasons as well as just the track.
Yeah, it's Indy and everything else.
The mere
fact
that that guy who wins this year, Newgarden, is going over exactly the same design track that Ray Haroon went over in 1911.
Isn't that remarkable?
And in the same place and everything. That's cool. I love Road America. I love Laguna Seca. They're both road courses that have, you know, nice character to them, a lot of elevation changes and everything, and I like that. Of the road courses, I guess I really like Long Beach quite a bit.
That was a fun one.
Not just for the track and the race it produces, and it produces some pretty good races, but the atmosphere around it. You know,
right.
you like the atmosphere at Indy, and it's different at Long Beach.
Right.
It's Barry definitely has a cool crowd.
Right on. Well, Paul Page, this was fun. Thank you so very much for bringing this alive to us here in our audience.
Thank you, Mark.
Yes, this was great. I wish you nothing but the best, and it was really an honor to speak with you today.
And was with you as well. You have a good time.
You too, sir. Have a great 4th. Thank you.